I started the 52-week challenge. For one, Pastor Hughes must have figured out that I'm a competitor, and he threw a challenge out there. So, I mean, that was it.
I wanted to set a goal and see if I could do it.
I felt that that was a calling for me to reinvest myself and my time into rebuilding that relationship with God.
I felt like a piece of me was missing. I was raised in church, and that was very important to me growing up. And so I wanted that for my kids too. So I felt like I needed to do the challenge myself to be a good example for them.
I thought, hey, this is something that I can actually do and meet and achieve that goal.
An obstacle that I have encountered during this 52-week challenge process has been having a baby.
I went to Disney in January and I ran what's called the Dopey Challenge, where I ran 48 miles in 4 days. And the full marathon just so happened to be on Sunday and started at 5 o'clock in the morning.
And I would say it was 2 sick children from the end of November till the beginning of February.
To keep that week going, I was running with my phone in my hand, watching Angie give the sermon. I was about 23 miles in at that point in time, so good thing I could see her, but she could not see me.
And we would rotate Sundays as far as, you know, somebody could go physically and the other was online.
Being able to see this online has been extremely helpful for me because I can pick what time that I want to get on and watch, and flexibility of not having to miss any.
If I was on vacation, I watched the recording either on live or archive. So it's very easy for me, I felt, to meet it.
I have grown spiritually, emotionally, mentally, in so many ways.
I could see God working, and yeah, I saw him working in my life, and it was just amazing. Some of the things that fell into place that I know it was God's hand in it, not mine.
I committed to a small group. That was something I've really been wanting to do for, honestly, years. And I got to the point where that was the next step for me.
Started serving on the meals team. I started cooking breakfast for the church, you know, alternating weeks. My daughter's to the point where she's almost even ready to start going to, I think it's Shakers and Movers is her age group. I mean, my son's been dedicated since then. It's all around. I mean, instead of it being an option, it became more so a priority, and everything else worked itself around that during that 52-week challenge.
Somewhere along the line, the challenge piece fell off. It wasn't something that we were aspiring to do. It wasn't something that we felt that we had to be challenged to do. It was something that we wanted to do.
It's just like crossing that finish line. I've never been to church probably 8 weeks in a row, let alone 52 weeks in a row. So, I mean, it was huge. It was huge.
Next year, I'm going to do it again, and I'm going to find other ways to grow, but push other people to do this as well, because it has changed my life so much.
Whether it's in person, which is what I prefer, or whether it's online, starting my week without that is just not even an option.
Well, way to go. For all of you who took and then completed the 52-week challenge, way to go. I wanted you to meet my friend Brady. I asked him to come today because he kind of inspired us to take a fresh look at this 52-week challenge. I saw him and his mom, Rachel, who I've known for a long time, on Facebook as they got close to their 52nd Sunday in a row coming to church. And I thought I'd ask him to join me today and share a little bit about his story with you. Brady, when you decided to take the 52-week challenge, like, what made you do that? Why did you say yes?
I wanted to see if I could go all 52 weeks.
You don't remember ever having done that before, 52 weeks in a row in church, huh?
No, it's challenging.
Well, that makes sense. I'm glad we named it well then. So how about when you were along the way in the 52-week challenge, did you find it hard to make every week? Were there some times when you thought about giving up?
Yeah, because sometimes we were sick, but me and Mom found a way to still get to church. on the online campus.
And sometimes you came physically and sometimes you were online. One of the things your mom told me was that when you were having some health challenges, when I issued this challenge over a year ago, and Rachel was saying that Brady looked at her and said, "Hey, Mom, how hard can it be?" Because after what you'd been through and some challenging days, you just thought, "Hey, we can do this." And you did. You and your mom encouraged each other. So were you counting down the days? Like, did you know where you were?
The hardest part was just waiting for Sunday.
So you looked forward to every Sunday.
Yeah, that was the hardest part, waiting for Sunday.
When you got to the 52nd Sunday, what did it feel like?
I was excited. Mm-hmm. I mean, I completed 52 weeks of going to church.
Yes, you did.
I was just really excited.
So you're going to do another 52?
Yes.
All right.
Another 52 weeks.
Well, I really am excited about it, too. You inspired me. You inspired a bunch of other people. Can't wait to see what happens on the other 52 weeks. Thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.
So a lot can happen. A lot can change in 52 weeks, right? I mean, as I get older, I think about how much life changes in 52 weeks, but a lot can happen in 52 weeks. Most obvious and something that everybody here today has in common is we all travel over 52 weeks. In fact, we travel 584 million miles every 52 weeks. That's the distance of the Earth's orbit around the sun. And during that journey, we get to experience some things. We get to experience seasons that bring changing temperatures and changing landscapes and weather challenges, right? A lot can happen in 52 weeks. In 52 weeks, for example, we can meet somebody we never knew existed. We can fall in love, get married, and make a baby. A lot can change in 52 weeks. Or you might begin a year living in your parents' basement, working a low-wage job during the day, but secretly writing a book, or maybe developing a new game at night. And 52 weeks later, you could emerge with a bestseller or a top-trending game. And nobody knew you a year ago. Everybody knows you now. A lot can change in 52 weeks. Kids, maybe you move to a new grade or maybe even a new school and you meet a new teacher and you make new friends. You don't look the same as you did a year ago. You lose 3 teeth. You grow 4 inches. You gain 10 pounds. You need new shoes, new clothes, new everything. A lot can change in 52 weeks. Or maybe after years or even decades of struggling with something unhealthy or even harmful, you make a decision, you decide once and for all that you're going to do whatever it takes to eat well or to exercise or to stop using or to face that trauma of your past or that debilitating tendency you have, those notions inside your mind that you know aren't quite right. In the 584 million miles that the Earth takes to travel in a year, your life can also make a light year's worth of progress towards your own health. Maybe you look back and you don't even recognize the old self anymore. A lot can change in 52 weeks. One more. At some point, you decide, I have to know more about God. I've got to discover why I'm here. Am I an accident? Was I created on purpose? If so, what is that purpose? And so you begin a journey. And it's not a half-hearted journey. And it's not haphazard. You actually plan for it. You get on a Bible reading plan. You get in a small group that has a study plan and a gathering plan. You have a research plan. So all of this you do so that you can figure out who this God is that everybody talks about, and you decide that you're going to embed yourself in a church. You dig in. You lean in. You listen well. You go through the awkward early stages of learning how to pray, and you stick it out. There are times when you want to give up, but you don't. And 52 weeks later, you emerge a different person. You don't know everything about God, but what you do know, you really know. And you don't know everything about your purpose, but there are some key components that are now clear. You don't know much about the future at all, But you do know that God is in it, that God is with you, that he loves you, that he's for you, and that he's got a plan for your life. And you know that, not because somebody told it to you, but because you discovered it on a journey that you took. Over the course of 584 million miles, a lot can happen in 52 weeks. We're going to come back to that in a few minutes. I want you to hold tight on that thought. Sometimes dramatic change doesn't take 52 weeks. Matter of fact, you and I have just experienced the most unprecedented and fastest change of our lifetimes. We don't even feel like we live on the same planet we did 12 weeks ago. Almost everything has changed. How we interact with each other, how we work, if we go to work at all, how our kids are educated, how we're treated if we get sick or need a doctor, how we communicate, how we plan, how we dress even, with face masks becoming part of our fashion. Almost everything has changed. Almost. In all the uncertainty, there are some things that have not changed. And we can stand on some solid ground. Even in the midst of a world gone crazy, there are some things that you can count on, some things that remain unchanged. In fact, in moments of crisis, these realities, they can become a rallying cry for the rest of the world, and you and I get to be the messengers of it. So with the ground beneath our feet giving way to an unstable, uncertain reality, you and I can be the voice that people are searching for right now, the voice of stability and the voice of hope, things that are still unchanged. We can grab a hold of those. That's what this series is about. And today, the first week, I want to tell you one thing that you can count on. The mission of your church is completely 100% unchanged. When I think about the church, not just our church, but the whole church, the larger picture of the church, I can say it wasn't always that way. In fact, like anything that lasts, the church began as something new. And when it was new, it was fragile and it was tentative and it was unknown and it felt uncertain. And I want you to go back for a few minutes with me. Go back in time. Come with me. It'll help us better understand and be more resolved about where we are today. We read about the formation, the beginning of the church in Matthew chapter 16. And we pick up the story there and it goes like this. Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi. And he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" On the surface, it might seem when Jesus asked them, "Who do people say I am?" It might seem that Jesus is being insecure, like he's worried about his public persona. But it would only seem that way. See, Jesus wasn't interested in politics. And he really didn't care about how many people followed him just so he could do something for them. The question that Jesus asks here really isn't about people. Even though he says, "Who do people say that I am?" he's not really concerned about them, about the group or the herd or the society. This question is really designed to test how solid the foundation is of his truest followers, the disciples. And what Jesus needed in order for this movement that you and I are a part of right now to take hold and to go forward, what he needed were just a few people in the early days to take a hold of this radical new idea and advance it into the future with an unchanging resolve, even in an ever-changing world. So Jesus asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" And they replied, "Well, some say John the Baptist. And others say Elijah, and still some other people say Jeremiah or one of the prophets." And Jesus says, "Well, what about you? Who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you, that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell itself will not overcome it." The church that you and I are a part of today, it had every reason to die. It should have died. The church that Jesus planted this day, right here in Matthew 16, it ought to be a footnote in history. Why would I say that? I want you to think with me for a minute about who Jesus is talking to when he asks them this question and he has this exchange with them. He has 12 people on his leadership team. They include 5 fishermen, a zealot who's obsessed with power, a dissenter who's filled with doubt, a despised tax collector that nobody liked, several people who were completely unknown, and oh yeah, a thief. These guys, all of them were relatively poor, not refined communicators, not well-connected, no one with special skills, not exactly the top influencers of the day, if you know what I mean, not the movers and shakers. But Jesus dares them to literally pursue something that will change the world precisely because of its unchanging mission. He's thinking about his church. And he says, I tell you, because Peter declared, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, Jesus says, I tell you that on this rock I will build my church and the gates of hell itself will not overcome it. Just a few weeks ago, when most of us thought of the word church, we had something in our minds. In fact, I'm going to challenge you right now. If saying the word church, what comes to your mind? Most of us automatically thought a place, a building. Or maybe we thought of a calendar, like a spot on our calendar, like a time, Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. But that was never what Jesus had in his mind. This is particularly relevant for us right now. We need to remember, or maybe we need to learn for the first time, what Jesus meant when he called that early group to build my church. When you and I hear that phrase, we think of something else, but Jesus' challenge was not for them to go out and grab their hammers and order the lumber. He's giving this ragtag group of unskilled, untrained guys a charge to launch a movement that would redefine the entire human experience. A movement that would flex in its method as the world constantly changed while being absolutely firmly grounded in a mission that would never change. When you and I think of church, we think of a building because, just to be honest with you, we have a little bit of a bad translation in our English Bibles. When Jesus uses the word church, he doesn't mean what you and I think it means. The word that you and I see as church in the Bible ultimately traces its roots back to this Greek word, this word ekklesia. When Jesus uses it, right here in Matthew 16, those 12 guys would not have thought of buildings or paved parking lots or coffee bars or offices or religious symbols or prayer rooms. None of that. In fact, the word ekklesia would not have brought any kind of building to their minds at all. See, ekklesia was a secular word, not a religious word. And it was used when citizens were called to gather for some kind of cause, generally speaking. It was used, for example, when soldiers would gather for a military cause, or when the community came together for the cause of helping farmers whose crops had been destroyed by locusts, or something like that. Ekklesia simply meant a gathering of people for the purpose of a cause that was greater than themselves, a movement, if you will. So Jesus is saying, listen, fellas, generally speaking, ekklesias come and go. They change from time to time. They rise and fall. And it's not that ekklesias are bad, but they're always changing. What we're going to create is not just another ekklesia. What I'm calling you to is the ekklesia, the gathering of people who would follow me, who would follow Jesus for the purpose of helping everyone follow Jesus. The ekklesia that will flex in method but will never, ever vary in its message. It will announce to the world that God loved it so much that he was willing to send his son to die for it. The ekklesia will be the tangible presence of the goodness of God. This movement, this ekklesia will be the voice of God loving every person in the world without partiality, regardless of how they look, regardless of the color of their skin, the location of their birth, the language that they speak, the flag they salute, or even the way that they think. This movement, the ekklesia, will show the whole world a way of sacrifice and selflessness. It will point people towards truth. It will answer humanity's most basic question, why am I here? Jesus said, and he taught, the expression of your ekklesia might change. That what it looks like might change. But the message of my ekklesia, he said, never will. And the mission to get that message out to every human being on the planet, that's never going to change either. That is the mission of the ekklesia. The church that Jesus predicted that day, that he said hell itself will never overcome, it was never about brick and mortar. It was never about programs or denominations or politics or many of the things, good and not so good, that you and I might associate with the word church. No, for Jesus, this was about the creation of a movement that would sweep like a spiritual tsunami throughout every town, every country, every village, every city, every nation on the planet, so that every man, woman, and child would come to understand that Jesus Christ came for them, that he loves them, that ultimately he laid down his life for them. So think about this with me. Those 12 guys, they were supposed to create a movement that would reshape the world. And the mission would remain unchanged from that day until this day and for the rest of human history. But there's more. There's more to the context that makes this truly important for you to see. I want you to see something that's so incredible here in Matthew that's so easy to miss. And so many times, for those of us who read the Bible, it's just easy to blow past. See, we started out this story like this. I even blew past it when we started. It says, Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, and he asked his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? And here's what man is. And this is what we do. We skip to the question. Who do people say the Son of Man is? We think that's the important part. But I want you to see Caesarea Philippi. Where is he? This place right here. Why did Jesus issue the mission here of all places? You might not know, so stay with me. Jesus was Jewish. That's at least his heritage. And much of his life that we read about was accounted for in Jewish territories. They were governed under Roman rule, but the primary religion in the area was Judaism. That's where Jesus did most of his life. Most of his neighbors and his friends and his circles and all of his family, they were all Jewish. And they all practiced Jewish customs and rituals like you would expect Jewish people to do, but not here. Not in Caesarea Philippi. This city is 120 miles north of Jerusalem. It's 25 or 30 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. But it was a world away in terms of culture and religion. This area right here was strongly identified with lots of religions, multiple religions. It was known for its worship of the Greek god Pan. It had several shrines to the god Pan in it. The city had previously been a center of worship for this false god Baal, and even Herod the Great had dedicated a temple there so that people could come and worship Augustus Caesar himself. So lots and lots of different gods being worshiped there. And Jesus drags the shabby dozen 100 miles north of home into hostile territory in order to issue his unchanging mission. And I think Jesus chose this place on purpose. I think he chose this place for this moment. And it might not mean much to you and me, but it would have been stunning to Peter and his friends. I try to picture this, as I encourage you to do when you read the Bible. Try to imagine what happens here. We're not given these facts for no reason, so I want you to speculate at least with me. When Jesus said, I will build my church on this rock, is it possible that he held a piece of dirt in his hand, some rocks, if you will, that were Caesarea Philippi? What if he really meant was, I'm building my ekklesia for people like that. I want the movement that bears my name to reach people who don't know my name. Imagine if, as he said these words, I'm going to build my church on this rock. Imagine if he at least waved his arm in the direction of the town's courthouse. It's very likely that they could see the shrine to Caesar, where people came and worshiped Caesar. Jesus declares the establishment of his ecclesia in the most unorthodox, most unexpected place, not surrounded by beautiful buildings or among the sound of powerful music, not in the presence of educated pastors or pious folks, but surrounded by people who didn't know God, people who would never go to normal church. They weren't interested in Judaism. Most of the people in Caesarea Philippi thought Jewish people were exclusive and arrogant. They were never going to become Jewish. They weren't even going to talk to people who were Jewish. But what they did have was a void inside of them, a desperation to really know God, like most everybody around you and me. I believe that the place where Jesus issues this challenge had everything to do with the charge he gave itself. It's like Jesus was saying, God revealed the truth of my identity right here, right in this place, not inside of a synagogue's walls. And I'm going to build a movement for people like those in Caesarea Philippi. Not simply for people who think alike, but surrounded by people who think differently. The kind of movement I build, Jesus is saying, won't remain in and among people who are already a part of it. The church I build will move to where other people are, those who are not a part of it. And that kind of church, Jesus said, well, that kind of church will last. That kind of ecclesia would remain unchanged in its focus, even while it flexed in its method. I want you to fast forward with me a couple of millennia now. We're moving quickly through time. It's 2002. And I was sitting in my living room with 15 people or so. None of us had ever started a church before. None of us knew anything about church as a movement or ecclesia, like I've been talking about. For all of us, for every one of us in my house that day, church was a place. It was an hour a week on a calendar. And it was definitely mostly for people who were already there. But we believed that we had heard God give us a mission of a new kind of church that would not be defined by its buildings or its decorations, but it would be defined by its purpose. It was almost like we heard God say to us, I want you to go find people who want to know me, who are searching for me, but who aren't already a part of the church, and I want you to help them discover the unchanging truth about Jesus Christ. We had a lot more questions than answers. We'd never done this before. So I'll just give you a few of them. Like, we wanted to know, where are these people? All of our friends were already in the church. Who are these people? What do they look like? How do they think? How do we go get them? And once we get them, what do we do with them? We had to be willing to lay down all of our preconceived notions about what we thought about church, what we liked and what we didn't. Was no longer a question we cared about. We had to set aside things like what we thought worship was, or where you thought we ought to do it, or what you ought to dress like when you come, or what does community look like, or how do we even make decisions? How do you do church without a building? We had no idea. We knew nothing. Actually, we knew less than nothing, because what we did know, we knew through years of tradition. So we had to unlearn not just what we had experienced in our lives, but a couple of thousand years of heritage that had been driven into the church. We had to relearn what Jesus meant by ecclesia that day that he declared it in Caesarea Philippi. I think that this is what Jesus had in mind. I think Jesus was saying the ecclesia would be a movement of unchanged mission and ever-changing method. Unchanged mission and ever-changing method. You know how the church gets stuck? The church gets stuck when it confuses what should change and what shouldn't. And I don't mean any disrespect here. I'm just stating some facts. After the resurrection of Jesus, the church, which started out as the ecclesia and a movement and exciting, and it expanded, it very quickly began to institutionalize. And along the way, as it developed a hierarchy, they decided that method should never change, but mission should. And when they did that, the church completely inverted what Jesus put in order. And they completely turned upside down the ecclesia that Jesus created. Instead of focusing outward to the people out there, reaching people and welcoming outsiders and guiding them towards God with culturally relevant methods, like Jesus did, by the way, they put a stake in the ground on how you do church properly. And they decided that the primary focus of our church would be the people who were already a part of it. Tradition became more important than reaching people with the truth of God's love for them through Jesus Christ. Lines got drawn. Style and form and ritual became the most important things. But that is not what Jesus said that day in Matthew 16. He's basically saying here, if you want to reach Caesarea Philippi, you've got to hold method loosely. And you got to make the message and the mission unchanged. Over 18 years that PCC has existed, we've tried to do that, and we've largely pulled it off, frankly. Our method has changed a lot. It's flexed, it's adapted, it's morphed, until, honestly, we don't really look much like we did 18 years ago. Not just the founding pastor, but the whole expression of our church. And then a funny thing happened. We didn't know it at the time, but around five years ago, I sat in a room with a bunch of our key leaders, and I said to them, we're going to agree together today to flex one more time. See, to that point, until that conversation, I'm just being completely honest with you, we had looked at online church as kind of a secondary, lesser option. Many of us didn't really consider it real church because we didn't understand it. Many of us, like me, didn't grow up watching a screen. I'm too old for that. So I just didn't understand. We didn't understand how you could really do church like that. And so I took them back in history. Just stay with me for a minute, please. And so I said to that group that day, I said, you know, when we launched our church, people told me that we weren't real church because we didn't have Sunday school. That's what they said. I mean, people got mad. They got in my face. And I tried to argue with them. I said, listen, we do church differently. We got small groups, not Sunday school. But they didn't care. They were fixed on the method, and they were unwilling to flex, and they considered any church without Sunday school to be illegitimate. They told me that. But we saw all the culture moving, and we decided to move our method with it. Today, many churches who didn't flex their method the way that we did are faltering, and I don't take any pleasure in saying that. So I reminded our team of that. I said, listen, we're viewing online church the way that the generation before us viewed Sunday school. And like them, if we don't embrace this new method, we're going to get left behind too. So let's agree together. From this day forward, we're going to give our online campus the full respect it deserves. Because this is where the world lives now, and we're going to adapt our method to advance an unchanging mission. We had no idea, I certainly had no idea that day, that we were doing far more than what I was saying with my words. But we were. So when coronavirus shut the whole world down, we were ready, because God had led us to build the ark before it started raining. So we just need to realize this together today. The world has changed, and we're never going to go back. We will gather our physical campuses. We're going to do that soon, by the way. We're working on a plan right now. You're going to hear an announcement very soon about our target date, and we are going to come together again, those of us who can, those of us who want to. But you need to know this. All of us need to know this. The online experience that you've been getting, it's not going to go back to the way that it was. The world has changed, but our mission is unchanged, and we intend to leverage technology to the farthest reach we possibly can, because God never stopped the movement he began 18 years ago. He never stopped the movement he began generations ago, thousands of years ago. In fact, he has only expanded it. We had no concept of more than one location for the same church when we started our church, but God gave us this crazy calling to do just that. And we launched a second campus, and then we launched a third campus, and then churches started calling and saying, can we be a part of it too? We launched in a prison, not a simple Bible study or just a group of outsiders who go in to save the prisoners. We took our whole church inside, and we looked at those guys in the eye, and we said, we're family now. You are PCC. Our church is moving, we're flexing, we're advancing, we're adapting, but it is absolutely unchanged in our mission. We reach people who don't go to church so that we can all experience the fullest lives possible through Jesus Christ. That was a mission we accepted then, we accept it now, and it's working all around this place, at every campus, at every gathering, and every place online. There is evidence that the ecclesia is accomplishing what God charged us to do. And as a result, people's lives are radically changed. And that happens not because we rely on ourselves or because we rely on our own ability, but because the God we serve is living and active and making a way for the impossible to become reality. God keeps his promises. He's the way maker. He loves every person. He empowers the ecclesia to do what he called us to do, to change the very world. And we're going to use every tool in our arsenal to do it. Because of who he is, our church exists. Because he never stops working. And because of that, lives are radically changed. And we invite you, we challenge you to become a part of the transformational power that is God moving through His ecclesia, through this church.
Yes, we challenge you. Come to church every week for 52 weeks, because a lot can happen in 52 weeks. And just like the people we heard from earlier, it starts off with a challenge, but becomes a priority because it is so much more.
All you have to do is go to our homepage, pccwire.net, and click on 52-week challenge. It takes less than 3 minutes to fill it out. Make that commitment to know a God who is living, active, and making a way for the impossible to become reality. Experience only the best change by committing your next 52 Sundays to the God who never changes. Click through that button and we'll see you back here next Sunday.